It took so many millions of lives that by the time the First World War finally ended, some were calling it the war to end all wars. In just a moment, we'll examine it through the poetry its soldiers wrote for an unfiltered view from the trenches.
Their poetry managed to get out to the world at large and convey what that war was really like in a way that nothing else did.
Best-selling biographer Michael Korda joins us in the hour ahead to remind us of the price that was paid in World War I and how it still haunts us today.
I have a rendezvous with death on some disputed barricade.
We'll also get you ready to explore rural villages in Turkey, where sightseeing can open you up to Turkish hospitality.
There won't be an attraction in the village such as a museum or a site, but the attraction will be you, an American, walking through the streets of the village.
Come along for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Today, we'll get ready to explore the villages of rural Turkey, where you can get away from the tourist crowds of the cities and experience the timeless hospitality of small-town Anatolia in just a bit. And listeners share the haiku they've written after hiking the trails of rural England and Scotland. Let's open this Memorial Day edition of Travel with Rick Steves, looking back to what started with an assassination in Sarajevo back in 1914 and ignited a devastating world war that lasted for 4 years. It brought about the end of 4 major empires, created new nations from their remains, and killed some 9 million soldiers and 8 million civilians. To understand what the First World War was really like, Michael Korda examines the words of a handful of soldiers in his new book, Muse of Fire. Their poetry, written from the trenches and battlefields, offers a brutally honest assessment of the savagery the politicians and diplomats had unleashed. Michael, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Now, you were a child during World War II, yet you write that you've always been interested in World War I. Why is that?
Well, although I was a child in World War II, I was 6 when World War II began, I grew up really under the shadow of the First World War. My maternal grandfather was English and fought in the British Army in the First World War. And my father and his brother both fought in the Austro-Hungarian Army in the First World War. Hmm. So I grew up in the shadow of people who had been in that war, and it had an effect on me. It signifies the end of European civilization as it was formed in the 18th and 19th century. Mm-hmm. It was as if Europe ran over a cliff.
Yeah, I understand we went into World War I with 5 royal families owning most of Europe, and by 1918, they were gone. That was sort
they were
of the
gone,
old regime.
Except for the British royal family, yes.
Yeah. Now, when I was a kid, it was my entire memory was World War I. But originally, it wasn't World War I, obviously, and they called it the Great War. Wasn't it even called the War to End All Wars?
Woodrow Wilson called it the War to End All War. Regrettably, he was wrong.
Yeah. But back then, it was a noble cause. I mean, young men thrilled to be involved in this, apparently.
Yes, and one of the reasons that I wanted to find a way to write about this war is because I couldn't conceive of adding another history of World War I to the bookshelves. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are thousands of them already in the English language alone. It occurred to me, however, at some point, that the British World War I poets and some of the American World War I poets fit neatly into each segment of the war. So Rupert Brooke fits neatly into the first months of the war because he died very early in 1915, and also allows me to write about the period before the First World War in Britain, the Edwardian Age, which was self-contented and optimistic, and then, as I say, suddenly in 1914 ran over a cliff. So each poet was involved in a different period of the war, but also deeply involved in the great battle of that particular time. So I saw that that would allow me to write about the whole war, but from a different perspective, through the perspective of their poetry and their lives.
I just love this, Michael, how this comes across. And in your book, it is just It's very engaging. I mean, if I could just jump in and read three lines of a poem from Rupert Brooke that you featured, and you said he died 1 year into the war in 1915. How old was he when he died? It must have been
28, I think.
And here's what he wrote. If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. Wow.
Yeah, probably the most famous lines, or perhaps the second most famous line of poetry coming out of the First World War. The most famous, I think, is Alan Seeger's, and I describe what an effect Seeger's poetry had, among others, on John F. Kennedy.
Hmm. So what was the most famous poetic line? Because it seems like that Rupert Brooke quote I mentioned there, it's easy to get your brain around, and it really sort of sings of the romance, the crazy romance of the war.
Death on some disputed barricade was John F. Kennedy's famous preferred line of poetry.
Rupert, that line again was, I have a rendezvous with death.
I have a rendezvous with death on some disputed barricade. And he was interviewed by Edward R. Murrow after he came to Washington as junior senator from Massachusetts. And Edward R. Murrow asked him if he read poetry and if he had a favorite line. And John F. Kennedy got up and walked to a bookshelf and took out a copy of Alan Seeger's poetry and read that line, I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade, which is, first of all, ironic, considering that it's about, I don't know how many years, but not that many years before his assassination. Mm-hmm. But secondly, how many television interviewers today would ask that question of a United States senator, and how many United States senators would be able to answer it with a line of poetry?
Michael Korda is our special guest right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Michael was editor-in-chief at Simon & Schuster for more than 40 years and has written 24 books of his own, including best-selling biographies of Lawrence of Arabia, Churchill, Eisenhower, Robert E. Lee, and Ulysses S. Grant. He's here to tell us about his latest work, Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the lives of the soldier poets. Michael, the unique feature of World War I, I think, was the immensity of the death and the reality of the trenches. It was difficult to grasp what the trenches were like, but a lot of this great poetry from World War I came from the trenches.
I think there are two reasons for that. The first reason is that in 1914-1918, poetry was still an important and popular art across a wide range of culture and class. Mm-hmm. Kipling, for example, sold in quantities like a best-selling novel today. And Rupert Brooke, in his lifetime as a young man, sold in enormous quantities. So people read a lot of poetry at every different level. It still mattered in a way that it does not matter significantly to us.
Well, as you said, it was the end of the Edwardian Age, you know, Victorian and Edwardian England up until World War I. It was a different time.
Very much so. I mean, you know, in the Victorian Age, the thing that most signified to people the horror of the Crimean War was Tennyson's The Charge of the Light Brigade. He read it aloud to Queen Victoria, who burst into tears as he was reading it. We don't have that kind of relationship with poetry anymore. And at the same time, the poets have become more inward-looking. So poetry is very seldom about great events or big news stories. So that's one aspect of it, is that the First World War took place at a time when poetry still mattered to people. The second is that poetry was not very strictly censored, if censored at all. The First World War was strictly censored. There were almost no meaningful photographs of it because the photographs that emerged from the war were mostly posed and intended to conceal what the reality was really like, as was the reporting from the war. There was no equivalent in the First World War, say, of Ernie Pyle in the Second World War. But the poets, their poetry managed to get out to the world at large and convey what that war was really like in a way that nothing else did.
So that's interesting. Poets went in under the radar.
Yes. But it's also notable that, for example, the First World War painters were organized into a cohesive group and given commissions as officers and moved quite far forward into the trenches to paint what are very often remarkable paintings, just amazing. However, they were not actually in combat. They were looking at combat. But the First World War soldier poets were all of them active combatants who experienced the full war.
So a photographer or a painter would be embedded and controlled by the military, but the poets, they were just combatants who happened to be scribbling thoughts in their little notebooks.
My wife Maggie and I went to the Jewish Museum on Fifth Avenue in New York to see the show of the Sassoon family. And Siegfried Sassoon's section of the show contains his notebooks, which are very small, about the size of a modern cell phone, and designed to fit exactly in the pocket of an officer's tunic. And he wrote his poems by candlelight in the trenches with a fountain pen in minuscule writing. You would need a powerful magnifying glass to be able to read it properly. And it's enormously moving.
Especially when you imagine, think of all of those notebooks that were just trampled into the mud and never seen.
Exactly.
It's hard to conceive of the death of World War One. I mean, it's half of all the men in France between 16 and 30 were casualties, something like that. That if you lined up all the English people that died in the war and you marched them by the cenotaph in London where they remember these deaths, if they marched by four abreast, it would take so many hours for them to march by. I mean,
It's nearly a million deaths in the United Kingdom in that four-year period.
And these poets were able to bring home the reality. People who died in the trenches and were celebrated after they were gone.
Many of them. Not all of them, of course, but many of them. Of them, Rupert Brooke and Alan Seeger and Isaac Rosenberg all were killed during the war or died during the war. And both Siegfried Sassoon and Robert Graves were very severely wounded. And Wilfred Owen, the last of the poets, and I think perhaps the greatest of them, was killed in 1918, 1 week before the signature of the armistice, and his mother received the telegram informing her of his death at 11 a.m. on November 11th, 1918, as the church bells were ringing all over England to celebrate the end of the war. So there are levels of irony and of tragedy in this that I think mirror the horror of that war.
Michael Korda introduces us to more of the soldier poets he features in his latest book, Muse of Fire. And he recommends sites to visit in Britain, France, and Belgium to better understand what they endured. That's in just a minute on Travel with Rick Steves. While the Ottoman Empire lost to the Allies in World War I, the Turkish Republic that emerged afterward is a fascinating place today, where you can walk among many layers of world history. A stroll around some of its rural villages might even make you feel as if you've also traveled back in time. A Turkish guide answers listener calls about visiting the villages of Turkey a little later this hour on Travel with Rick Steves. Right now, Michael Korda is our special guest. He's editor-in-chief emeritus at Simon & Schuster and has written some 20 books of his own. His latest provides an intimate view of the First World War through the poems some of its soldiers wrote about what they saw and experienced. It's called Muse of Fire. In your book, Michael, we meet these poets. We see photographs of them. We read their poetry and the story behind it. And we learn of their romantic lives. And romantic, not in a kissy, mushy, junior high kind of way, but romantic meaning in the dramatic struggles of nations against nations and battles of attrition. And you get these poetic people in the trenches and you bring them to life in your book. Now, we've talked about Robert Brooke. We've talked about Alan Seeger. Let's talk about Isaac Rosenberg.
Isaac Rosenberg fascinated me I included him and Alan Seeger, two people who had served in the ranks in the war. Most of my soldier poets were officers, and I needed people who had served as common soldiers. Rosenberg is quite fascinating because his parents came out of Russia in the years when Jews were only allowed to live in the Pale of Russia, which is the westernmost area of Russia that now comprises Poland, Belarus, and the western part of the Ukraine. So they came out of this enormously repressive Tsarist regime in which violent anti-Semitism was the actual policy of the state. And so Rosenberg came from a family which really didn't speak English. They knew Russian, they knew Yiddish. They hardly spoke English at all. And yet Rosenberg emerged almost immediately in early youth as a very great poet and perhaps also a great painter, because his paintings are quite remarkable. And yet none of his poetry was published in book form while he was alive. It's only after his death that he became famous.
So this was a man who was from a poor Russian immigrant family in England. He was killed in action in the last year of the war, 1918,
yes.
And he was just 28 years old. And let me read I'm going to read six or eight lines from a poem.
Surely, I would enjoy that.
Isaac
please.
Rosenberg, and then we can talk about that. The wheels lurched over the sprawled dead, but pained them not, though their bones crunched. They left this dead with the older dead, stretched at the crossroads, burnt black by strange decay. Their sinister faces lie, the lid over each eye, and our wheels grazed his dead face. You couldn't write that without being there.
No. And also without that painter's instinct for the picture and the reality of something. Rosenberg was not only unlucky and poor, but also a very poor soldier. He never managed the all-important feat of looking like a soldier.
Yeah.
Which
your description of him really makes that clear. And his poetry really vividly depicts the grim and violent reality of the war. You said his poetry was expunged of patriotism, glory, and heroism. And when I read that, I thought, you know, England works very hard to have museums that don't glorify war. And it is an inclination of pop culture or whatever to kind of glorify war and simplify war. But it is, I think, a journalistic duty and a part of being a good, honest poet is to tell it straight.
Yes, I think so.
Michael Korda is the author of Muse of Fire, World War I, as seen through the lives of the soldier poets. As we've heard, Michael's father and uncles fought in the war. He tells their story in his 1979 book, Charmed Life. Michael was born in the UK to British and Hungarian parents and served in the Royal Air Force. He was awarded the Order of Merit of the Republic of Hungary for his role in the 1956 Hungarian Revolution. Michael makes his home in the Hudson River Valley. Let's talk a little bit about how travelers, this is a travel show, by the way, let's talk a little bit about how travelers can take the inspiration they get from this poetry and incorporate it into their travels. What sites would you have us have on our list about World War I when we go to Britain, France, and Belgium?
Well, in England, I very strongly recommend seeing the Imperial War Museum, which is quite extraordinary and actually has a simulated trench which will give you the entire experience of what it was like to be in a trench in the First World War. In addition to some magnificent paintings.
Let me underline that, Michael, because that is one of my favorite sites and one of the most underrated sites in London, the Imperial
Indeed.
War Museum. And war is a big part of the British heritage, and this tells it from a very human, unglorified point of view in a way that anybody can embrace and be inspired by.
Yes, I think that that's absolutely true. It's an awesome experience. There is also in Chelsea, though fewer people visit it, the Museum of the British Army, and has a marvelous collection both of paintings and other things. You know, there are these surprising things that you find in British museums occasionally, and that's one of them. I was very moved. I was in Oxford giving a speech about T. Lawrence. I wrote a biography of Lawrence of Arabia, and stopped into the Bodleian and was absolutely awestruck to find that in a glass case is T. Lawrence's robe and sandals and his headdress from those years that he spent organizing the Arab Revolt in 1917 and 1918. And there it was. It was in a very strange way, moving, because whoever would have guessed that it still existed,
right,
and was on display. So, but the two museums you mentioned, I think, are extraordinary and well worth visiting.
You know, one thing that's not remembered is any firsthand experience in World War One. Now that it's more than 100 years ago. And when I'm in London, you know, right on the main drag between Big Ben and Trafalgar Square, you've got the Cenotaph. And this doesn't mean a lot to me because I'm not that tuned into World War One, but I get a sense that in Britain, to this day, 100 years later, the Cenotaph really is a powerful memorial to the people of Britain.
It is. It commemorates the dead of World War One, and certainly in Great Britain, November 11th is a very serious day. There are 2 minutes of silence,
mm-hmm,
beginning at 11 o'clock, which was when the Germans signed the armistice. But it's 2 minutes of national silence. Nothing moves, nothing sounds. There's 2 minutes of complete silence and commemoration of the First World War dead, and almost everybody wears, as I do, on that day, a red poppy in their lapel or in their hat.
And I've been there on that day, and it really is silent. People do respect that 2 minutes.
Oh, absolutely.
It'd be a hard time to grind our country to a halt on something that happened 100 years ago, but Britain certainly does. Michael, let's go to the continent now, and you've had a chance to pay attention to this and think about it and travel. In France and in Belgium, what are a couple of experiences, monuments, sites that you have found very compelling and inspiring?
Well, I think in Belgium, the 1914 battlefields, Mons and Ypres, are enormously moving and compelling. I think in France, though there's a wide range of things to see, that the most moving thing I know is the Austriel, filled with the bones of dead who could not be identified at the Battle of Verdun, which between French and German dead added up to, I think, over 1 million dead. And the Verdun battlefield and memorial is, I think, about as awesome as it gets.
And that's the proper use of the word awesome. I think people diminish that word by saying everything's awesome. If you want awesome, go to
this
Verdun.
This is awesome on a different scale.
You go to Verdun. And the bones of 1 million unidentified soldiers or whatever, I don't know the number, but it's an unimaginable amount in a building that seems to me as long as a football field. And it's surrounded by a sea of crosses and stars of David. And wow, to be there, it is just awesome. Michael Korda has some 20 titles to his name. He's joining us on Travel with Rick Steves from New York City as we look at how poetry illuminates the realities of the First World War. His latest book is Muse of Fire, World War One, Seen Through the Lives of the Soldier Poets. Michael, let's talk again about a couple more poets in the time that we have remaining. You feature Robert Graves. Tell us a little bit about Robert Graves and why you've got him in your list of poets from World War One.
Well, I think Graves is one of the most significant poets, British poets at any rate, of World War One, and lived to a great old age. He wrote, I think, over 120 books, including I, Claudius and Claudius the God, and was, even in old age, an impressive figure, about 6'2", with the build of an athlete and this shock of white hair. And his book, Goodbye to All That, is, I think, by any measure, probably the best memoir of a young infantry officer to come out of the First World War. It's always in print. It's constantly read. It's enormously moving and is quite quite literally a classic.
And here's four lines from Robert Graves. "You smug-faced crowds with kindling eye, who cheer when soldier lads march by, sneak home and pray you'll never know the hell where youth and laughter go."
Yes.
My
yes.
goodness. And then the way you describe these poets, middle class, well-educated, physically fit, enthusiastic, brave, they signed up early in 1914. But he was a young man of great sensitivity and strong emotion, not at all the reckless daredevil he attempted to be. Well, this is a whole dimension of World War One that can inspire us today.
I think in every case, these people are enormously moving. I found Alan Seeger fascinating, partly because I didn't know that much about him, except for the fact that he was Pete Seeger's uncle.
Right.
But his roommates at Harvard were T.S. Eliot and John Reed. You could hardly imagine a more powerful threesome of young men than T.S. Eliot, John Reed, and Alan Seeger.
And these kids were privileged kids going to fancy colleges in the United States. They didn't really have to go to this war, but they
No. Seeger wanted to. He joined the French Foreign mm-hmm. Legion. There were several hundred Americans living in France who very much wanted to fight for France once the war broke out. But the difficulty was that joining the French army would deprive them of their American citizenship without making them French citizens. And the French, needless to say, found a solution to
right.
this problem by getting them to join the French Foreign Legion, since that's separate from the French army. So Seeger, who could easily have rode the war out and not gone to it at all, joined up in August 1914 with enormous enthusiasm.
So they moved all sorts of rules, and he did all sorts of heroics to be able to join the battle in order to be killed
yes.
at the Battle of the Somme yeah. in 1916.
Yep. Killed at the Battle of the Somme.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been talking with Michael Korda. His book is Muse of Fire, World War One as Seen Through the Lives of the Soldier Poets. Michael, it's been such a delight to be able to talk to you and to be inspired by your work. And I would imagine when you put this much work into something about something that happened 100 years ago, you're thinking about what is the takeaway for today. What are your thoughts about that? Some parting thoughts on the world and poetry and war and peace.
Well, first of all, it's not so unusual for poetry to define a war. When you think about it, all we know about the Trojan War is the Iliad and the Odyssey, two poems. The ability of poets to encapsulate and describe a war goes back for many, many hundreds of years, if not thousands. Secondly, if the First World War illustrates anything at all, is that war seldom settles anything. There is no such thing as a war-to-end war. Each war is only a step towards another. And that's borne out in so many ways by the futility of the First World War and by the lives and deaths of the First World War poets.
I think 100 years from now, they might look back and call World War One and World War Two a continuation of the same war.
Exactly so.
Now, what about Ukraine? I would imagine you can look at Ukraine today and think, wow, 110 years earlier is something remarkably similar.
Yes, very much so. Very much. Of course, we don't know how it will come out yet. And it's also being fought over much the same ground that was determined in Europe by the end of the First World War, the collapse of the Russian Empire, the fragility of the new nations, the impermeability of the frontiers that were established then one way or another. All of the problems that confronted the Allied powers in 1919 as they tried to make a peace settlement after the war are still haunting us today, and the Ukraine is a perfect example of that.
And Michael, think of the notion of a battle of attrition. I mean, that was a calculated thing in World War One. We will bash
Absolutely.
Our heads together. We will bash our heads together and take unprecedented losses, but we calculate that the enemy will bleed white and drop first.
Indeed, and officers and generals were severely reprimanded for not having sufficient casualties.
Right. And then the tonnage of artillery 110 years ago and the tonnage of artillery today.
Well, you know, I'd like to say, above all, that despite all the manifold and extraordinary things that have changed warfare, that the war in the Ukraine exactly mirrors a smaller version of the First World War. It's hard to believe that over 100 years since the First World War, people are still digging trenches and living in them, and that victory in the war depends on immense artillery barrages, not of hundreds of thousands, but of millions of shells. It's as if the spirit of the First World War is still with us.
But Michael, where are the poets today?
I don't know. I would like to see them. I wish I spoke or understood Ukrainian. Perhaps I would be able to read their poetry. But I'm sure it exists, and I'm sure that will always be the case.
Michael Korda, such a beautiful conversation, celebrating the poets who can help us learn from history. Thanks for your book, Muse of Fire, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
We have web links to Michael Korda's work in the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Advice for getting off the busy tourist trails in Turkey and visiting some of its rural villages. That's next on Travel with Rick Steves. We're at 877-333-RICK or email us at radio@ricksteves.com. In Turkey, as in other countries, the big famous sites are found mostly in the big cities, like Istanbul. And you should visit those cities and check out those sites. But I've found that if you want to really experience the heart and soul of a country, you need to get out into the countryside as well, where things change more slowly and where tourists are all the more welcome, in part because they're so rare. Turkish tour guide Lali Sermon Aran lives in the hectic metropolis of Istanbul, but she also enjoys spending time in village Turkey. That's where life moves at a very different pace. Lolly's here now to give us some tips on how we can do the same. Lolly, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you, Rick.
I remember a long time ago traveling through Turkey, and the highlights for me were getting to little towns where when I got off of the bus, everybody in the bus said, no, 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 don't get off here. Nobody gets off here. And I wanted to get off there, and I wanted to see the little village. I remember the industry, I used to nickname it hay, dung, and ducks. All of the industry seemed like hay that was being gathered, dung, dried cow pies, really, for fuel, and ducks running around. Is there still a chance to get into very rural, very simple village life in Turkey today?
Of course, things are changing everywhere, such as in Turkey, too. At the moment, 70% of Turkish population are urban dwellers, but it doesn't mean that we don't have little wonderful villages here and there still carrying on their traditional lifestyles and traditional daily life. And yes, there are places like that you can go out. They're obviously off the beaten path, not places that regular tours would be going. You have to do a little research before, ahead of time.
But these poor villagers likely do not have a car and they use public transportation, so small buses would go to these towns from medium-sized cities?
Yes, dolmuşes operate.
Dolmuşes. And what is a dolmuş?
Dolmuş is a morph between a taxi and a shared bus.
So it would be a minibus that goes generally to a village and
yes,
it'll stop and go where people like it to stop and go.
Yes, and they usually operate from the otogar, bus terminal of the nearest bigger town.
Okay, so you're in a regional capital, you know, a small city, 20, 30, 40,000 people. There would be the otogar, the bus station. You got the big buses going to Ankara and Istanbul.
And the minibuses to the villages.
I gotcha. Okay, now why would a tourist want to go to the trouble of going to a village? What are some of the rewards of getting into a village that has absolutely no tourist industry?
They are great. To start with, you will get to see the real people in their daily routine. And while they appreciate seeing visitors, their livelihood is not the visitors, so they treat the visitors as a personal visitor coming in, not a tourist that's planning to spend on money.
Is that part of the culture? What is the traditional Turkish or Muslim approach to a visitor walking into your village?
We say these guests are sent from God.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. Say that in Turkish.
Allah misafire.
So this person who stumbles into our village is really sent by God. So
yes.
Take good care of him.
Yes, exactly.
So what is a fun thing to do in a village? Take just your image. You're with me in a little village. What would we do as just, because there's no museum and there's no great palace to see. What would we do to have some fun and make some memories?
I would first recommend that you take a walk around the village to get an idea of the size of it and the people in it. And yes, there won't be an attraction in the village such as a museum or a site, but the attraction will be you, an American, walking through the streets of the village.
And what would I say? So, I mean, people are going to be staring at me. I might be kind of self-conscious.
Say hello in Turkish, merhaba.
Just smile and nod and say merhaba.
Yes, be down to earth and be nice, and people are very welcoming and hospitable. If they see you, that you have a smiling face, and if you want to reach out to them, they'll reach back out to you. Just take a little walk in the village and then go to the village center. In the village center, in every village center, there would be a grocery, there would be a pharmacy, there would be the town hall, the local town hall, and the coffee shop.
And what would I do in the coffee shop? There's a good chance.
That's where people hang out,
mm-hmm.
Especially after a long day at the field, in their gardens. Go in there, just check in, order a Turkish tea, such as everyone else is doing. It's the ritual. The tea will be served to you in a tulip-shaped glass cup. And start staring at people, and they'll be staring back at you too. And if you see any playing a backgammon game or a tile game, show some interest, and then they'll invite you.
They will. It's automatic almost. They will invite you to join the party.
Yes. And it's automatic from there on.
How do you say backgammon in Turkish?
Tavla.
Tavla. So if I looked at a friendly man who was staring at me and curious, and I said, merhaba, and then I said, tavla, might get aboard and play me tavla?
Yes, immediately.
Is that
immediately.
Right?
Immediately. Uh-huh. But you need to remember the trick. Whoever loses buys the tea.
Okay. And a cup of tea probably cost in American how much?
In such a small village, 50 cents.
50 cents. So mm-hmm. You got to be able to buy everybody a cup of tea, and you'll have a memory for the rest of
your
life.
Yes, exactly.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and each week on Travel with Rick Steves, we help you explore the world thoughtfully and get an idea of the fascinating people we can all get to know. Joining us right now is Lolly Sermon Aran from Istanbul, and we're talking about getting into village life in Turkey. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Mike's calling in from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mike, thanks for your call.
Hi.
Hey, do you have a comment or a question for Lolly about village life in Turkey?
About 4 years ago, I traveled to Istanbul and Ankara and Ephesus, and it was a life-changing thing for me. Everyone was very friendly. My background is that I'm Armenian, and my parents were born in Ankara and in Van, and I was very nervous about my first trip and found the Turkish people to be very warm and friendly, and I was just wondering, I'd really love to visit the eastern side of Turkey. Is there an issue with me being Armenian?
Well, of course, for our listeners that might not be aware of this, the Armenians and the Turks had a very difficult period in their history 100 years ago, and a lot of people are still angry on both sides about this problem. It was, people use the word genocide and so on. It's a horrific thing any way you spin it. And then Armenians have a heritage, and they want to go back. And there's a lot of Armenian Turks that are woven into the contemporary society today in Turkey. And there's a lot of people that still have a problem. Lolly, for an Armenian-American to go back to Turkey, what concerns should they have?
As a matter of fact, none. Mike, I am partly an Armenian too. That's my heritage.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not the only one, obviously, in Turkey to have an Armenian heritage. There are hundreds of thousands of people like I am. And events that occurred during the World War I or afterwards are obviously very sad, very tragic events. But those of us in Turkey, we moved on and we accepted the events as they were. And as long as you do not carry a political statement with you,
mm-hmm.
you will be just any visitor in Turkey.
Okay.
And I have helped over the years, I have helped many American Armenians to travel to Turkey and find their family lineage. I help them find their family homes and help them travel to...
So
little nooks and crannies in Turkey, and they all returned back from Turkey with wonderful memories.
And there are beautiful and evocative Armenian sites in eastern Turkey.
Yes, there are.
And I think most of the Armenian culture and today there's a country called Armenia, which is over the border. Is the border open between Armenia and Turkey?
No, it's not.
So you can't get back and forth. And sadly, a lot of these Armenian sites today feel like ghost towns, and they're
some
the
of them are
of them.
Recently restored, Rick. Especially,
are they?
Okay. Yes, a very important church in Lake Van has been recently restored.
Oh, beautiful. But the,
yes,
but, the,
it is
but,
beautiful.
The, but the living culture is in Armenia north of the border, really, and these are historic sites.
Yes.
And I just think, you know, I respect an Armenian who wouldn't even want to go to Turkey. I mean, that's up to them. But if you are an Armenian that wants to go back to Turkey, and as Lolly said, if you don't have a political axe to grind, you will find a warm welcome and absolutely no danger or concern about traveling through Turkey.
Well, I found Istanbul to be really quite wonderful, and
that's
everybody
great.
Was very, very friendly.
That's
and most of the Armenian I know is actually Turkish, so.
Good. Hey, well, Mike, I'll tell you, I've some of my very favorite travel memories anywhere are in eastern Turkey looking at those Armenian sites. So good luck. I would recommend for you to go for
it. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to trying it.
Thanks for your call, Mike.
Bye.
Bye.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and I'm talking with Turkish tour guide Lolly Sermon-Aran about spending some quality time in the small towns of Turkey. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and you can email us at radio@ricksteves.com. And Gloria's emailed us from Bethel Park in Pennsylvania, and Gloria writes, I'd like information on a one-day cooking class in a Turkish village. Also, what are some of the most charming villages? Well, if you wanted to learn how to cook, would you take a class or would you just meet a woman in a household?
In Istanbul, there is a small group of housewives who can speak English and teach what they are cooking. And what they do is that they usually meet with their guests in or around the spice market. So they start the day with shopping different spices.
So these are cooking tours in Istanbul then?
I wouldn't call them tours. They are done on private basis.
Okay. So you hire the local cooking guide.
Yes.
They take you to the market shopping and then?
They teach you about the ingredients, the main ingredients, the side ingredients. You shop for what you will cook for the day. And then you move on to the house together using public transportation.
And with
what you have in your shopping bag, you cook the meal and then you eat the meal.
That sounds great in Istanbul. If we're in the far corner of Turkey where people are not likely to speak English and you're in a village with a thriving market, you might have a challenge, but you could still witness how people are shopping and how they're eating. What would be some advice for somebody who likes Turkish food and they're in a village? How might you learn about the cuisine or even get a chance to do some cooking?
It needs to be a little bit more organized with more people involved, at least somebody to translate.
Yeah.
Because majority of the village women wouldn't be talking English.
So realistically, you'd need to hire a guide, an English-speaking guide from a big city. And there's lots of good Turkish guides looking for work.
Mm-hmm.
And they could take you out into the villages. And I can think of, if you like to cook and if you like Turkish food, boy, to hire a guide for just a day in a big city and go out into the countryside, into a village and see the market and meet people. And the way Turkish hospitality is, it's not that tough to get invited into people's homes.
No, that's very easy. We like guests very much.
We're learning how to make new friends in the Turkish countryside with Lolly Sermon-Aran right now on Travel with Rick Steves. Lolly runs SRM Travel. It's a tour company from her home base in Istanbul. She and her husband, Tan, also operate a boutique hotel called Cappadocia Estates. It's in the village of Mustafa Pasha in central Turkey. They're also co-authors of the Rick Steves Istanbul Guidebook, and their website is srmtravel.com. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, as Sally joins us on the phone now from Lavelle, Pennsylvania.
Thank you, Rick. I'm a single woman traveler, and I really love traveling solo. I've wanted to go to Turkey for some years now, and recently an opportunity came to visit travel in the eastern Turkey area of small remote villages. You know, some may not have even seen many or any tourists. And I was wondering, I tend to be very open-hearted and smile on my face, and I tend to draw a lot of warmth from local populations when I travel. So I have several questions. One is, how would that be for me traveling as a solo woman in a remote village in eastern Turkey?
talking of different parts of Turkey, the information I can give you are different. If we're specifically talking about eastern Turkey, that's one part of the country where you would not see many single women traveling alone.
And it might be misunderstood. In other words, it would be not wise for a single woman to travel alone in eastern Turkey, especially not speaking the language.
Yes, and you will attract too much attention, too much curiosity, and it might be uncomforting to a level.
Now, I've traveled with women in eastern Turkey in the most remote corners, and it was a beautiful partnership. A man and a woman traveling together, you know, the woman attracts a lot more fun and attention than the guy will sometimes, and together it can be safe, and it becomes quite a festival. People would invite him into their homes, and we'd have all sorts of chances to hop on ox carts and go for little rides and play games with the kids and slice up a honeydew melon, and there's so much fun you can have. But a woman alone, I think, is a little risky.
And is that the case throughout Turkey, or where would you feel safe, if anywhere, as a woman alone?
Except for eastern and southeastern Turkey, I would safe everywhere else as a single woman.
You're okay.
Yes.
And now, do you define eastern Turkey as east of Ankara?
East of Cappadocia.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of tourists as far as Cappadocia, relatively
yes.
speaking. But when you get farther east than Cappadocia, then you become an adventurer. There's really not so much organized tourism beyond a few adventurous tour buses.
I had encountered an opportunity to house care for someone in a remote village that direction, and so I just was a little curious.
And what's the village?
Oh, I have to look it up. It was about 2 hours almost directly east of Ankara and north of Cappadocia.
Sally, it is exciting to think that you could get into these villages, but it's just a lot more comfortable if you have a guide or a man with you.
And the other thing was, I'm wondering, with Syria positioned as it is and Turkey being on the way from the Middle East to Syria, does that raise any concerns at this point in time for traveling in Turkey at large?
No, not at all. Syria is a different country.
Yeah, the distances are huge there. I think Turkey is the size of California, and there's oftentimes disturbances over the border in a number of different directions, and you wouldn't want to wander off in areas near borders. I've been traveling, filming near borders and in contested areas, and we get stopped a lot by military police, and they wonder what the heck we're doing there. But if you're just roaming around the countryside as a normal tourist, you should be fine, but steer clear of the borders if there's something going on the other side. But the Syrian conflict really should have no impact on what's going on for travelers in Turkey. So, Sally, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. This is Travel with Rick Steves. We've been joined by Lolly Sermon-Aran. We're talking about the traveler venturing into Turkish villages. Lolly, let's cap our conversation with just some advice from you on what might be sort of the perfect opportunity in a village. What would make the village experience just really, really memorable?
Social interaction. Especially in the religious and national holidays, people don't even close their doors. It's the time to visit one another. There's always food wherever you go. You visit one house, and then you visit the next house, and then you visit the other house. And meanwhile, everyone else is also visiting one another. There's always a commotion at every house, people coming in and going out. You get to see the people that you have not for a while seen. Talk about everything. It's when men, women, and children, everybody participates in this. They are usually in their best attire. Gifts are given. Desserts are offered. Tea is offered. And that's the time I love to be in a village.
And if there's 1,000 Turks during a special festivity day in a village and there's 2 Americans strolling down the main street,
just knock on the doors and keep visiting homes.
You're just the celebrity in the town and you're more than welcome.
And as a matter of fact, there won't be even need to knock on the doors because most doors will be open for visitors to walk in and out casually.
Sounds like very good travel. Lolly Sermon-Aran, thanks so much for a peek into your beautiful country.
Thank you.
No problem. Hadi Türkiye. Tala tala gel domatese gel. Viyan monsieur viyan.
Poşetleriyim ben.
Viyan monsieur viyan.
Domatesine bak.
Tamam diye yenilerde örnek alır. Hadi bakalım.
Some of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners were inspired to compose an original travel haiku after hiking in Great Britain, from the Scottish Highlands to the streets of London. Here's what they sent us at ricksteves.com/radio.
Carla Wright of Georgetown, Kentucky, connected with more than nature while hiking in Scotland. Walking Ben Nevis, an eternal thin place near to God in Scotland. Ian Park lives in Burley and Wharfdale, England. He knows all too well how you have to be prepared for anything when planning a stroll in the wilds near the Scottish border. Crossfell, Pennine Way, needs a day of fine weather. We didn't get it. And he reminds us, when drinking tea, milk always goes in last of all, as the Queen Mum did. While Daniel Roberts of Lambertville, New Jersey, has this advice on trying to strike up a conversation over beers in Glasgow. No Rosetta Stone for a Glaswegian voice. Just peel the pub egg.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington, by Tim Tatton, Kazmira Hall, and Donna Bardsley. Andrew Wakeling and Sherry Court upload the shows to our website. Our theme music was written and performed by Jerry Frank. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. You can find links to our guests and search the show archives at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.
My public television miniseries, Rick Steves' Art of Europe, takes you on an exciting sweep through the entire awe-inspiring story of European art history in 6 hours. Watch the series from the Parthenon to Picasso on your local station or stream it on PBS Passport or at ricksteves.com.